You're listening to CKMS 102.7 FM in Warlow, Ontario, radiowarlow.ca on the web. This program is a part of the Local Journalism Initiative grant program and is funded by the Community Radio Fund of Canada, the Government of Canada, and the CKMS Newsroom. You can access the recordings of this show on radiowarlow.ca/news or on the National Local Journalism Initiative website. My name is Ivan Angelovsky. With the COVID-19 situation and a lot of people losing their jobs, the federal government introduced the Canada Emergency Response Benefit Program. CERB gives financial support to employed and self-employed Canadians who are directly affected by COVID-19. If you're eligible, you could receive $2,000 for a four-week period, the same as $500 a week. With that, a lot of people started to think about whether Canada would need such a program if there was already a universal basic income in place for people getting exactly into that situation. Recently, we published a story on Kitchener's Council initiative to urge the provincial and federal government to start talking about universal basic income. In that story, we aired a short excerpt from the interview with Hugh Siegel, who's been fighting for universal basic income for the last 50 years. Mr. Siegel is a political strategist, former senator, former chief of staff to Ontario Premier Bill Davis, and later to Canadian Prime Minister Brian Mulroney. He recently published a book called Bootstraps Need Boots, One Tory's Lonely Fight to End Poverty in Canada. It's been published by UBC Press. Mr. Siegel, thanks for the interview. Your book has an interesting subtitle. Can you explain why do you feel lonely?
Well, generally speaking, the conservative point of view with a small c in Canada has not been in support of broadening or reforming the way in which we try to reduce the level of poverty in Canada. Classically, people on the right wing tend to live within cliches like, well, you know, if you pay people automatically without working, then why would they ever work? Or, you know, people have to pull themselves up by their own bootstraps. We've all heard those sorts of things over the years. And certainly when I was active as a member of the Senate on the file, I was not able to get any support at all from the then conservative government that was in power in Ottawa. There were some individual conservative MPs and senators who were supportive of the idea, but the government itself showed no interest at all and continues as a party now nationally to show no interest. So that's why I would have used that subtitle for that particular book.
You experienced poverty yourself. Can you describe that experience?
Well, I grew up in a home that was, I guess, the low end of working poor. My father was a cab driver. He was an immigrant from what is now White Russia, which more Belarusia. My mother had to work all night in a medical arts pharmacy downtown, and often it was a normative experience not to have enough money for the basics, you know, rent, heat, food, clothing, transportation. And in our situation, I was fortunate that I had two very kind and loving parents who were very committed to making do as best they could, as most parents would try to. But we were not amongst the poorest in Montreal. There would have been other families who were doing substantially worse than we were. So that gave me a personal exposure between the ages of, you know, I guess when you become aware, maybe 5 or 6, and till I went to university, of how serious poverty is as a source of discouragement in people's lives and as a constraint in terms of the core premise of our society, which, in my view, is equality of opportunity. I'm not a great fan of legislated equality of outcome. I don't think that's constructive. But equality of opportunity is something which I think is basic to our society. And poverty, as it grinds away across the country, and there's about between 3 and 4 million Canadians who live beneath the poverty line, they have more health difficulties earlier on in life. They often have more family problems. The kids don't do quite as well at school, all of which feeds a cycle which is terrible for those people, first of all, and is not very constructive for a productive and humane society, which is supposed to be based on equality of opportunity.
Can you remember when and how you first came across the idea of universal basic income?
Yes, I can. It really was in 1969, so that's quite a few years ago. I was 19, and I was then a student at the University of Ottawa, and I was a volunteer intern in the office of a young member of parliament from Prince Edward Island. His name was David MacDonald. He was a United Church minister, and he had built his reputation in Prince Edward Island by working with a Catholic priest, which in those days would have been quite radical, to try to address some of the social and income problems, alcoholism, and other difficulties on Prince Edward Island. And then we had the 1968 general election, which Pierre Trudeau, the father of the present prime minister, won very successfully. So when a political party is defeated in that way, that's when it usually begins to have meetings and conferences about, well, what should we do for the future? What should our policy priorities be? And one of these conferences, which was called Priorities for the Future, was held in Niagara Falls, Ontario, and David MacDonald presented a paper on the importance of a basic income and how it might work and why it would be better than the welfare programs we have across the country, which, generally speaking, are based on the poor laws of the 18th century, which are very judgmental and punitive, which do not pay people much more than about 40% of the poverty line in their respective provinces, by and large, and which actively discourage work. So that's where I first saw the idea. That's where I first understood it. And I've been fighting one way or another to try and make progress on it ever since.
I'm Ivan Angelovsky, and this is Radio Waterloo. If you're just tuning in, we're talking with former Senator Hugh Siegel about his 50 years fight for universal basic income in Canada. So during Kathleen Wynne's government, you were invited to design a pilot program to test the basic income idea. Can you describe how it came to that?
By all means. When I was a member of the Senate, I worked in a nonpartisan way with Arthur Eggleton, who was also a senator, and he was a Liberal senator from the Toronto area. I was a Conservative senator from Kingston, and we came across a very compelling young scholar from the University of Manitoba, Dr. Evelyn Forget, who had done a remarkable analysis of the one basic income pilot that we had done in Canada, which was done in Manitoba in 1975. And typically Canadian kind of political history, the government of Manitoba changed, then the government of Canada changed, and so the program was stopped after 3 years, and no one did an analysis of whether any of it had worked. Well, she took upon herself the job to do peer-reviewed research, and she came across some really interesting findings, which spoke about less use of the healthcare system, people showing up to work even though they had this basic income guarantee, and it indicated that it would be a program that not only would reduce poverty and insecurity, but would also reduce healthcare costs and other important areas of expenditure. When I left the Senate in 2014 and became the principal of Massey College, she applied for and was accepted as a visiting scholar at Massey, having done all this work and having had it all published. And when the Premier of Ontario heard that she was at Massey College, Premier Wynne invited both Dr. Forget and myself to come and talk about the idea of basic income, which we did. And it was on the basis of, I think, that discussion that the Premier decided that the old welfare system really was not adequate and we could do better in a way that was more productive and more humane and less stigmatizing. And that's when I was asked a few months later in 2016 to put together the basic income pilot design, which I was pleased to do, and which became the basis for the pilot project that was launched in the following year.
What was the thought process in designing the pilot?
The most important thing about a pilot is that it should not bring with it a bias. It should not be structured to prove that the idea is always going to be perfect. It should be structured to test whether the idea is in fact better than what we're doing now. Better in terms of results, better in terms of cost, better in terms of commitment to the labor labor force and to educational and healthcare outcomes. The program was designed so as to test with a control group, which would have been those folks who are on the normal welfare program, versus another group who would leave welfare and go on this basic income pilot. And there'd be a difference. The amount of money that someone back then, a single recipient of welfare in Ontario, would get would be about $640 a month, which would take them to about 45% of the poverty line. The number in the basic income pilot was $1,300 a month, which got you to about 75% of the poverty line, but was much more generous and supportive. And for the recipients of the Ontario Disabled Support Program who would get $1,200 a month, that amount was increased to $1,700 a month. The difference is that the pilot did not discourage them from working the way welfare does. And if they worked, they would pay a reasonable level of taxation on what they earned. And when they earned the same amount as they were getting in the grant, then they pay the same level of tax that all of us do on our income one way or another. And the only defining criteria was that they were now with an income that was beneath the poverty line. I knew from my own personal experience, and we know realistically that in Canada today, 70% of the people who live beneath the poverty line actually have jobs. Some have to have more than one job in order to make enough money to try and get by. They picked Hamilton, which is an urban area, which is sometimes affected by economic swings, and they extended it to Brant, which is part of the rural extension, I guess, of Hamilton. And then they went to Lindsay, Ontario, which is just outside of Peterborough. And then they went to Thunder Bay, which is also affected by economic swings. And there were to be roughly 4,000 people involved in the pilot. And we were going to measure their personal circumstances when the pilot started, how those changed when the pilot went into effect, what was their relationship with the workforce before, what happened during the pilot, what was their health circumstance before it started. How did that change, if at all, during the pilot? What was their housing circumstance before it started? So it was all about measuring those things on an individual outcome basis, except for Lindsay. In Lindsay, they also added a measurement of community outcomes. So, for example, what were the use of the healthcare system in the local community? What were the police finding in terms of crime rates and all of that stuff? So had the project continued for the 3 years, we would have had hard numbers on cost benefit, on community benefit, and on individual benefit and cost. And that would have given the province a model to see what it would cost to implement it if they wanted to, based on the results of that particular pilot. But sadly, as it was stopped within a year of it starting, they never really got enough numbers to come to any conclusion.
So from your perspective, how did it play out?
Research has been done in the Hamilton area by the Department of Economics at McMaster University. What they found was all the results that one would have hoped. In other words, people were using the money, the guarantee money, to go and get better education so they could improve their job prospects. As some were using it to hire child care so they could do more work themselves and earn more money for themselves and their family. Some were using the money to start a small business, which they felt they could benefit from and give them some financial independence. There were some individuals, one particular woman I recall, went and bought at the age of 47 her first new winter coat ever. Those results indicated that the project was heading in the right direction, but because the project stopped prematurely, they were only able to get the results of 1 year. The results were very encouraging and would indicate that a basic income where there is no stigma, where it's a private relationship between the individual citizen and the tax department, like the CERB that is now being used to provide emergency funding for people whose jobs were lost because of the shutdown, produced all the positive outcomes that would be economically productive and quite manageable in terms of cost for the province going forward.
If you're just tuning in, I'm Ivan Angelovski and this is Radio Waterloo, and we are talking with former Senator Hugh Siegel about the Ontario Basic Income Pilot Project he designed. The program was implemented by Kathleen Wynne's government and was running for a few months, but then came elections in 2018. Can you explain what happened during those elections?
During the election, interestingly enough, all three parties, including Mr. Ford's party, took the position that they were going to wait to see, after the 3 years of the pilot were completed, what the results were, and then they would come to a decision based on the actual results of the pilot. When Ford became the leader of the Progressive Conservative Party, and he was asked by the Toronto Star, his campaign was asked whether they were going to continue the program, their official spokesman said twice that yes, they liked the idea of the pilot, they found it interesting, and they would wait to see the results before they made any decisions. So, sadly, when they got elected, they did not keep that promise, and they canceled the program right away.
After that, have you had a chance to speak with any of the recipients?
Oh, yeah, there have been meetings in Kingston, and in there was a march that I was part of in front of Queen's Park back in September of last year. I have gone to meetings in places like Hamilton and elsewhere where I've had a chance to talk with recipients. And the story is often the same. I remember a young woman from Lindsay who had used the money to start a business. The business was going well. It was beginning to generate extra income so that hopefully at some point she wouldn't need any support. And then when it was pulled out from under her, of course, the business collapsed and she ended up in worse shape than she was before the project had started, which was very heartbreaking and very unfair because these people who signed up for the program were volunteers. They signed up in good faith because the government had assured them that this program would last for 3 years and they would be able to make those changes in their life over that three-year period, which could be constructive. So I think it was the decision, quite aside from the politics of the matter and quite aside from whether they liked the pilot or not, I think to treat folks who came forward in good faith to be part of an experiment, low-income people who, for good and substantial reason, aren't all that trusting of government or large institutions. But they set those fears aside, and they're prepared to be part of it, and then the rug was pulled out from under them, which strikes me as very unfair.
This is Radio Waterloo, and I'm Ivan Angelovsky. I'm talking with Hugh Siegel, former senator who designed the Ontario Basic Income Pilot Project that a lot of people are now talking about as an alternative to all the programs introduced with the pandemics caused by COVID-19. Your program was criticized from all sides. People on the left were saying that it could cut other services, such as healthcare. What do you say to them?
I've heard those criticisms, and I know some of the economists and others on the left who are making the case, and I have nothing but the greatest of respect for them, but I think they're wrong, and let me tell you why. The present system, and you could see this when the government decided that they couldn't use employment insurance to deal with the 7 million Canadians who found themselves out of work one morning because of the shutdown of non-essential businesses. They had to go to a new approach, which was not rules-based, not tied to casework management by thousands of bureaucrats, but rather tied to an automatic filing with CRA, the Canadian Revenue Agency, so that the money could get to people quickly. And I know of many people who were eligible and who filed online on a Monday and had the $2,000 deposited in their bank account by the Wednesday. Now, the problem with those on the far left, and I say this with nothing but the greatest of respect, they are as myopic on this as people on the far right. People on the far left think, well, if we do this basic $1,300 or $1,500 a month or whatever the number ends up being, that will collapse all the other social programs. Well, I've always only been proposing this change for the cash transfer part of income security. That's when we now spend something like $172 billion a year in Canada making personal cash transfers to Canadians, provincially and federally. And I'm not for changing the programs that are out there helping people with learning disabilities or health care or mental health challenges. I'm not for touching any of those. I'm just for improving and modernizing how we deal with the cash transfer project. So there are two approaches to how you treat people who are in need. My bias is you treat them as citizens. You give them as much freedom as is humanly possible to make their own choices with the money they have the right to get because they've fallen beneath the poverty line. There's another view. The other view is, no. You shape programs, and the programs are shaped by the swells and the well-intentioned public servants and the politicians and whatever. And then the poor people will accommodate themselves to the programs that other people have designed. And, of course, they'll have to prove their eligibility for those programs in a process which is endlessly bureaucratic and, in some cases, quite demeaning. And I think that that second approach is really a modern version of colonialism. I know that when the Royal Commission on Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women made a recommendation for a basic income as part of its recommendations for how to deal with the problem, when they were asked, well, wouldn't it be better if we had special programs designed by the government for young Indigenous women, which would help them? And the response was from the people working on the commission, that is just a modern version of colonialism, where other people decide how you live your life.
But can you explain to me, why would I want to work if I'm getting the basic income from the government?
Because the amount of money you would get would not be sufficient to live a comfortable life. It would be basically sufficient to meet most of your needs, be about 75% of the poverty line, and that would give you an incentive, because most people do want to work, and most people want to be out in the marketplace, and most people want to earn more for themselves and their family. Unlike welfare, which gives you very little money and then says you can't work, this would give you a basic boost, but still not anything to keep you in any great comfort, and encourage you to work. And there is simply no data from the recent pilot project that was done in Finland and the pilot project that was done in Manitoba in the mid-70s that showed any reduction in the desire to work on the part of people who knew they would have a backup if their income collapsed. So there's just no evidence to back up that right-wing view.
I'm Ivan Angelovski, and this is Radio Waterloo. If you're just tuning in, we're talking with Hugh Siegel, former senator who designed the Ontario Basic Income Pilot Project that was implemented during 2018 to test whether that would be a better way of serving people in immediate need. A lot of people are now talking about it as an alternative to CERB and other programs introduced during the pandemics. Now, Mr. Siegel, if we had basic income already in place, can you imagine how different would the COVID-19 situation play out?
Here's what we know. We know that, generally speaking, your prior health condition is a determinant of the risk that you face from COVID-19, number one. So those people who are already living in poverty are more susceptible to a worst-case scenario. So therefore, if there are less people living in poverty, we'd have less people susceptible, number one. Number two, we know that the results of the COVID-19 and the public health officer's advice has been that we have to shut down all non-essential businesses, which produced on, you know, literally over a period of a couple of weeks, 7 million new unemployed Canadians. The government of Canada determined that they couldn't just rely on the old employment insurance system, the EI system, because it too was very convoluted and very complex, and it required either algorithmic decision-making or individual case management, which would have taken too long. I support the fact that the government of Canada, through the Bank of Canada, moved quickly to make sure that the banks and the large financial institutions had the liquidity they needed, the cash they needed to manage through this difficult time. I don't oppose any of that. And that was done very quickly. That was literally done overnight. The notion that you could do that for the big players and have no answer for the instant liquidity needs of regular folk who find themselves without a job and without any income makes no sense to me at all. And so if we had a basic income in place as it was envisaged in the pilot, individuals could have simply gone online to CRA and say, my income used to be $42,000 a year. It's now zero. Therefore, I qualify for the basic income. And they could have put the money in their bank account within days, the way they did for the CERB recipients, a program which had to be cobbled together quickly. I give the government great credit for having done so. But if we had a basic income structure across the country now, then we would have had that infrastructure in place, which would have produced probably a more efficient and a more humane way of making sure that people were not without necessary cash, and it would have been part of the income security system of our country.
Okay, finally then, on a scale from 1 to 10, how convinced are you, Mr. Siegel, that we are going to see universal basic income in Canada anytime soon?
I would say I used to be somewhere around 4 or 5. I'm now in the 8 area, because I think that this particular event that we are going through now, the COVID virus thing, where all of a sudden 7 million hardworking Canadians who had jobs and were earning a reasonable salary, and some were in hospitality, some were artists, and some were freelancers, and some were working on projects, but all of them ended up without any income. I think there's now a much greater understanding in Canada of how people can end up in poverty through no fault of their own. That poverty is not reflective of a moral failure on the part of those who are poor. Often it's a reflection of circumstances beyond their control. And so I think that sets the stage for a very constructive debate. And when we go to the lessons learned part, what did we do right on public health? What did we do right on the economy? What could we have done better? There'll be a very strong coalition. And all the polling that I have seen indicates that, generally speaking, about 70 to 75% of Canadians think a basic income would be a significant improvement over what we have now.
Mr. Siegel, thank you for the interview.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye now.
You've been listening to CKMS Newsroom at 102.7 FM. We talked with Hugh Siegel, a former senator who's been fighting for universal basic income for the last 50 years. And recently he published a book called Bootstraps Need Boots, One Tory's Lonely Fight to End Poverty in Canada, published by UBC Press. Check out the archived versions of this program and other episodes on radioworlu.ca/news. You can follow us on Twitter at radioworlu, and you can email news@radioworlu.ca to get in touch with comments or ideas about stories to cover. The music was Black Room by Moby, thanks to MobyGratis.com. My name is Ivan Gelovsky, and I was your host for this program.